And Rod Oram is our business commentator. He's in the Auckland studio. Good morning, Rod.
Good morning, Catherine.
Where do we begin today?
Well, let's just have a very quick chat, if we may, please, about the Climate Change Commission's draft report. Not to go over all that they're suggesting, but rather more to focus on the response to it so far, because we're kind of halfway through the period that people have to write submissions to put to the Commission. And my basic view is that the Commission's done a very useful and good job of bringing together a lot of what we knew about how to fit together the strategies and the actions we need to take to decarbonise the economy. And it's also done some more work of its own towards that. I have a couple of reservations, and they're quite big ones, is that it's tended to focus on near-term solutions that are already here or will be soon and are very easily identifiable as economic to do. But, of course, this landscape is changing so fast that that's of constantly moving and in many ways improving picture. So I'd like to see a rather more dynamic analysis from them. And the other thing is they are very, very light on what are known as nature-based solutions. And this doesn't apply just, say, to agriculture or forests or ecosystems. Nature-based solutions actually apply to built environments, to urban areas too. And there's very light reference to that. But globally, nature-based solutions are about a third of the solution, and they are very right for us because we've got such a huge store of natural capital here that we don't use well. We rather degrade and all the rest. And therefore, I would argue there are very great opportunities for us in nature-based solutions, both out in the rural and wild parts of the country, but also in urban New Zealand as well.
All right. The nature-based is interesting. I'm not sure if this is the same thing. They seem very wary of the idea of using carbon sinks as a way out of this and of tree planting, for example, as a way out of this because you simply run out of options and time. And they seem very focused on trying to get people to concentrate on actually cutting raw emissions. With the natural solutions, could you just explain a little bit more about what you meant?
Yes, so that is a really important point. And I'm with them all the way on the undesirability of more than a little exotic plantations like radiata pine. Better to do native trees because you get better resilience of those plantings in climate terms, but also in a richer ecosystem in those native regenerating forests. But you can also do things like restore wetlands or increase the carbon sequestered in soil. So there's an awful lot more you can do in terms of sequestering carbon, but the nature-based solutions go beyond that. So, for example, if you think about substituting in urban environments, timber and engineered timber, a phrase about how you sort of enhance the properties of wood to make buildings rather than steel or concrete, which have very significant carbon footprints, then you are building, I and others would argue, a more attractive built environment, but you're also sequestering carbon that's still locked up in that wood that you've used. So that would be an example of urban nature-based solutions, but also about using, again, another technical term, ecosystem services, the way natural ecosystems do things like clean water and provide us other services, making sure that we move to the extent we can our urban systems away from outright industrial systems of wastewater treatment and stormwater treatment to using more of those nature-based solutions. So it's things like that.
All right. And any other particular observations?
Yes. There is an interesting pushback coming from a dozen or so business and industry groups that have written to the Climate Change Commission seeking more information on the way the Commission has been using modelling. And they want to sort of really lift the hood on all that modelling. So this is organisations such as Dairy New Zealand and the Meat Industry Association, Federated Farmers, Stratera, the mining industry group, Motor Motor Industry Association, New Zealand Initiative, Business New Zealand, people like that. And they have a good point. The modelling is very complicated. And in the 650-page evidence report that lies behind the draft recommendations, there is a lot of discussion about modelling and how it was done. But and I hope so far the Commission hasn't given them the sort of information they want, and I hope it does. But I think these organisations need to be really clear that they mustn't dive down the rabbit hole of arguing about those models, because those models are significantly imperfect. They can give you a sense of how various actions would play out about the economy, through the economy, but they're not at all accurate in forecasting the cost or the benefit from them. And so, for example, in that long discussion about modelling, there are examples in the Commission's report about how the European Union uses three completely different macroeconomic models when it's working on these issues, and comes up with, on one hand, GDP being enhanced by decarbonising the economy by a little bit, but also a negative cost by a little bit. So you get this range. So I would caution very seriously those organisations not to obsess about those models, because computable general equilibrium models, which is what we're talking about here, computer models, are very, very imperfect. And we've got to make decisions on a whole bunch of good, sound analysis, and rather than just being hung up on these economic models.
It's interesting, I thought about the whole report, actually, and I saw some commentary afterwards. You know, it's kind of getting back to the 1970s, managed economies to go into that level of detail over how something can be done. To me, this is really a demonstration of one way it could be done. And that's why I'm very interested in your idea of a dynamic model that can alter as things change.
Yes.
Whether it's something's going better than others, or things going worse than others, or initiatives we weren't expecting. What it did was demonstrate, in theory, you can do this at this level of cost. And I know that level of cost is also a subject of debate. It's not a blow-by-blow instruction manual. It was a demonstration of what would be possible.
Absolutely. And very importantly, put all the pieces together, because it is a very complex task we've got to pull off here. And in many ways, it's actually the doing of it that is far harder than the financing of it. And the actual negative impact of not reducing emissions and the positive impact for doing so are far greater than haggling over these computer models about very small differences in GDP. And that's why, for example, both the UK modelling, which again uses two different ways of approaching this, what's known as the resource cost assessment versus the macroeconomic model. And here in New Zealand so far, we've just gone for the macroeconomic model. It's really, really important to keep this modelling in perspective, a useful tool, but it alone can't dominate our discussion. There are far bigger issues that we have to deal with to make our decisions.
All right. Now, the results season's well underway. What's caught your eye?
It's been a very good results season in many ways. Obviously, there is a difference between those sectors of the economy, which are most of them, which have come through the pandemic and the lockdowns well, and of course, versus tourism and aviation in particular, which haven't. And we've seen no shocks. Companies have been able to be and been very responsible and very clear about how their fortunes are tracking. There'll be no real surprises on the upside and likewise on the downside. So, for example, Auckland's airport losses were as deep as expected, which is not surprising since international passenger numbers have fallen by 97% in the half year to December versus the previous year. So we're comparing COVID with not. And indeed, domestic passengers were down 45% in this half year to December. But at the depth of the lockdown. They were down, obviously, far greater than that. But the company is well-financed. It had a $1.2 billion rights issue to shareholders early in the lockdown, and it's using the light traffic well to do to bring forward a lot of renewal of taxiways, runways, and the rest. So it's tracking well. Another good example is Contact Energy. Now that we know the TY smelter is not going to close for another 4 years or so, we've got a much clearer picture about energy generation and consumption, which has given Contact the confidence to go ahead with a major new geothermal project it's going to be building near Taupo. If there's a disappointment, definitely Fletcher Building's results. Yes, their profits are up sharply, and it's going to resume paying its dividend. But it said it was kind of greater efficiency lay behind that. I was actually hoping for some more exciting news from them about how they might do more and better home and apartment building, because after all, we've got a housing crisis in the country. Indeed, Fletcher Building itself opened up a prefabricated home components plant in South Auckland in October 2019. And I'd love to have heard how that was doing, because that's a very important, you know, way to do housing quicker and more affordably. But none of that. Their only lament was that their stock of finished homes was not as great as they'd like it to be, and they could easily sell more. But I was really surprised was that given this very overheated housing market, they've only managed to increase the average price per home they're selling by 5%. So I'd have some real, I hope analysts have got some real questions of them. Obviously, a lot of those sales get locked in, you know, before construction actually starts, so there's a long lag. But I was surprised that Fletcher wasn't making more money out of this housing boom.
And others you've got your eyes on?
Well, the big one, of course, to watch is Air New Zealand, which is on Thursday, and analysts are forecasting a before-tax loss of about $220 million versus a profit of $270 million. So that's a half a billion-dollar turnaround because of the pandemic. But and it's going to be interesting to hear how they are progressing on this stop-start Trans-Tasman travel, for example, isn't developing as fast as they'd hoped. And it's very interesting to hear how much more air freight they're doing these days. And I'm keen to hear that about that. But the really big issue is their rights issue, because unlike Auckland Airport, they went to the government and lined up borrowing rather than going to shareholders and getting equity. Now, that was complicated for Air New Zealand because the government is the majority shareholder and was probably not very keen to stump up equity at that point. But Air New Zealand is saying it'll definitely do a fundraising, a rights issue before June. And analysts are expecting this to be big. It needs to be about $1.5 billion to pay back the government money it's borrowed from it at very high interest rates, and to give it plenty of resource to get through at least the next couple of years. The loss for this full financial year could be easily $500 million, and very slim, the best trajectory is very slim profits next year, and it could be 2023 before it returns to a reasonable level of profitability.
Right. Now, what's happened with Pacific Aerospace?
Oh, just touch on this very briefly, because I know we've spent a lot of time so far. Thank you for the time. Pacific Aerospace has gone into liquidation. This is an interesting company because it's our one and only aircraft maker based at Hamilton Airport, with a long history that goes back more than 50 years to the development of crop dusting planes. And they do make a very good single engine passenger and cargo plane. But it's got the pandemic's been difficult because it's obviously lost deliveries, and it was a Texas supplier of aircraft components which put it into liquidation. But it's a very murky situation because Pacific Aerospace is in a joint venture with a Chinese partner to build copies of the aircraft or in China, and that clearly hasn't been going well. And there are and the Chinese partner has well. I think as this liquidation flows through, we will see, we'll understand a lot better what's been going on. However, there has been a bit of an expression of hope that it might be possible to take these assets and get them back into a business so we can continue, so that we can continue to make the aircraft here. And that's a worthwhile thing to do because there's some serious industrial skills and capability that that the company represents that would be good to keep.
All right. And Allbirds, another big company with strong New Zealand connections, looking at an IPO.
Yes. All the talk in the States is that it's heading for an IPO over there. It'll be quite a big one because its most recent round of fundraising through venture capital valued the company at about $1.7 billion. A very good story about its rapid growth since it was founded in 2014. And Tim Brown, one of the founders, a New Zealander, an all-white soccer star, and New Zealand wool feature in these shoes. It's a very good sustainability story. And it'll be very interesting to see how well the IPO goes.
And there's an executive promotion that you've got your eye on.
I do, because it's a really interesting one. Greta Stevens is CEO of New Zealand Steel, but the parent company, BlueScope, which is Australia's largest steelmaker, and owns New Zealand Steel, announced yesterday she was becoming its, quote, global chief executive for climate change. And Stevens has a really interesting background in engineering and material science. And before she joined BlueScope in 2018, she was CEO of the TY Point smelter, for example, and prior to that, a general manager at Pacific Aluminium. And the steel industry is one of the hardest in the world, along with cement, in terms of trying to reduce emissions. And BlueScope has operations in Australia, the US, China, India and Southeast Asia, as well as New Zealand. So it's got lots to work on. And at the moment, its climate goals are very modest, which is no surprise considering the difficulty of reducing emissions per tonne by only 12% from 2018 levels by 2030. There's a lot of very, very interesting, really out there stuff technology-wise going on in the steel industry trying to crack this problem. And it'll be interesting to see if BlueScope might be at the front of it. But it's a great, it's a nice accolade for Greta Stevens that she's got that global job.
Thanks very much. Rod Oram, business commentator.